waters. This land was made for you and me.
It's November 24th, 2019. I am your host, Bill Humphrey. Joining me after our several-month hiatus, back on the show, Arsenal for Democracy, Lend-Lease, which we're continuing as our podcast spinoff until the end of the calendar year. Joining me are Nate. Hi, Nate.
Hey, Bill.
And, as always, Rachel in Idaho. Hi, Rachel.
Hi, Bill. Hi, Nate. Glad to be back.
So, as folks know, we took a little bit of a hiatus for a few months while I was in the final stages of my city council campaign. I was successful. I have been elected to the Newton, Massachusetts City Council for the next term. So we decided after the election that we would pick things back up with our very popular Lend-Lease spinoff podcast of the Arsenal for Democracy radio show. We did 12 episodes this summer. This is episode 13, which, as I said, we're recording on November 24th, 2019. And our current intention is to bring back the main radio show. The primary radio show should be coming back around the first week of January or so. We're still figuring that out, but that's why we're continuing with the podcast for the moment. So it's no longer a summer podcast spinoff. It is now also a fall and winter podcast spinoff. But you may recall that we had a pretty good run of 12 episodes, a lot of them really focused on history stuff. Those were generally our most popular episodes, especially where we were talking about leftist history, you know, in the United States and U.S. relations with other countries. And it's something that, you know, we had done plenty of times on the normal show as well, but this gave us an opportunity to do sort of more specific dives on that. We had talked about left-wing and social democratic housing policy in various cities and countries around the world. We had talked about Medicare for All and some of the, you know, origins of that. We talked about socialist mayors in the United States historically. We did an episode about piracy in various places and times around the world. We did some more current episodes talking about, for example, the Democratic Party power struggle, which is something that obviously I am an active participant in now as a elected, soon to be in office elected official. We did an episode about social rights versus individual rights in the U.S. political context. We talked about U.S.-Soviet relations and the Communist Party of the USA, and we did a very long two-part episode about anarcho-syndicalism in the United States. And then we closed out our summer session with episode 12, which was about the trade unionism action happening currently in several countries, including the United States. And it's been really interesting, I think, to see kind of some of the syndicalist-ish rhetoric continue to accelerate from Sarah Nelson, the head of the Flight Attendants Union, which was something we talked a lot about on that episode. Anyway, those episodes are still available at arsenalfordemocracy.com or from iTunes or wherever. And we are now looking ahead. Today's episode is going to be about U.S. involvement in Mexico in a specific period of time, mostly around the Woodrow Wilson administration period. We've also got upcoming episodes in some undetermined order about the Oklahoma Green Corn Rebellion of 1917. Senator Harry Lane of Oregon, who served from 1913 to 1917, an episode on Hawaii Communists, the Hawaii Democratic Party, and how to build a multiracial workers political movement in the United States. And there's a number of other things that we've also got in the hopper as potential options that we're still kind of figuring out. If you have specific ideas, you can always hit us up. The easiest way to reach us is on Twitter, at AFD Radio. You can also usually reach me at Bill Humphrey MA, but that might be getting a little bit harder as we get closer to me taking office. Have to figure out all the rules about social media accounts for that. But as I said, we are talking today about U.S. operations in Mexico under Woodrow Wilson and shortly thereafter during the Mexican Revolution Civil Wars period. So let's jump into that. For context, we are talking about a period of a slightly before Woodrow Wilson and a bit after, but mainly we're talking about 1910 to 1920 in Mexico. And I know that Nate's going to talk a little bit about some of the context of that because he was listening to another podcast about some of the background stuff. But again, we're focusing mostly on the U.S. Involvement. So just a kind of a quick timeline here without going into a whole lot of detail. There was this guy, President Diaz, who had been in power for 30 years. There was a 1910 coup d'etat by a guy, Madero. He was elected in free elections in 1911. And then, again, for context, Woodrow Wilson gets elected president of the United States in 1912, at the end of 1912. And then Madero has a pretty short-lived tenure. He's assassinated in 1913, which then kicks off a series of civil wars in Mexico. General Huerta is the guy who kills Madero and seizes power. He was explicitly staging a counter-revolution against Madero's sort of, I would say, liberal revolution, probably more so than any kind of left revolution. But a coalition of revolutionary forces forms in 1914, the next year, to militarily defeat and remove Huerta from power. Then, over the course of 1914 and 1915, the revolutionary coalition breaks up and triggers a civil war. Again, as I alluded to, there's a bit of a tension, which happened in many countries' revolutions, between liberal revolutionaries and left revolutionaries and various other tendencies and strands. Not everyone always agrees on what the objectives of their revolution are. So, unfortunately, this coalition breaks apart and there's a civil war. In 1915, Carranza and Obregón, their military forces, backed by the United States, as we'll talk about, prevail over Pancho Villa and Emiliano Zapata, and Carranza becomes the president. Villa and Zapata go underground and continue guerrilla operations. Then in 1917, a radical constitution is adopted, more radical even than Carranza. In 1919, Zapata was finally killed. And then in 1920, sort of bringing an end to this initial period, although, of course, ushering in a much longer period of Mexican history. In 1920, Carranza is deposed and assassinated by the so-called Sonoran Triumvirate. Carranza basically tried to hand off power at that point because there was a one-term rule in the Constitution. He had this guy picked out as his sort of unknown puppet, the ambassador to the U.S., but that guy didn't really have the profile or political support of the revolutionary generals needed to actually, you know, take power. And so these northern generals who had been involved in backing Carranza previously remove him, and they sort of trade around power amongst the three of themselves. And we can get back into that more, but I don't want to, you know, jump too far ahead. So that's sort of the timeline that we're working with in this initial period. And again, Woodrow Wilson is in office from 1913 to the beginning of 1921. And we wanted to talk specifically about two particular incidents, although the U.S. is a presence throughout this entire story. We want to talk about the 1914 U.S. military occupation of Veracruz, and we want to talk about the 1916 U.S. punitive Pancho Villa expedition. Now, the other thing that I want to say before we get to Nate and Rachel on the research they've done on these specific points is, again, a reminder of the timeline of what else is happening in the world, because that is also an important context for what's going on. So Woodrow Wilson, first elected 1912, re-elected in 1916. One of the key things that Wilson campaigns on for re-election is that he had managed to keep the United States out of World War I, at least up until that point. Of course, subsequently in 1917, he does bring the U.S. into World War I. But for the period of 1912 through 1916, the U.S. stays out of the war, which had kicked off in Europe in the middle of 1914. But again, that military buildup that precedes World War I factors into this story, as well as then the actual war happening also factors into what's going on in Mexico, because various parties are trying to vie for, you know, depending on who wins the struggle in Mexico, will Mexico end up joining the war as well as its own, you know, potential party in the struggle, in addition to all the efforts to try to bring the United States into the war. The United States does end up entering the war, but not until April 1917. So that's the timeline of events that we need to know. So let's talk about 1914. This is before World War I has officially kicked off. Let's talk about the invasion and occupation of the port city of Veracruz. So, Nate, this is the one that you looked at pretty closely and did some research on. What happened here, and what do we need to know about this?
Okay, yeah. So as Bill mentioned, I listened to a little bit of the Revolutions podcast with Mike Duncan, although just in terms of the context, I sort of just listened to the episode about this, so I was sort of flung into lots of different names and characters that had already been established because it's sort of a long-running thing that he does. So I don't know how useful that would be. But I think sort of it's important to figure out like the context and the spark behind this sort of, because this gets talked about like in sort of like overview history courses and things like that, but it's maybe not like emphasize like what the actual reasons behind it were or what sort of the overall impact on the situation was, just because it's like, oh yeah, we just invaded Mexico again. Okay. That's the thing we do. So,
and of course, as you're alluding to, there was definitely a lot of U.S. military actions in other countries, but mostly much smaller countries in Latin America. And this was a more potentially much more significant thing if it had escalated further.
Right. I mean, of course, there's all the gunboat diplomacy and sending, say, Marines to, you know, Nicaragua or places in the Caribbean that was happening around the same time. But I guess we start off here with the, it was called the Tampico Affair. And there have been the federal forces of President Huerta were in Tampico, and there were apparently a large constitutionalist force outside or in the surrounding area. And also, and I'm reading from a book, Oil and Revolution in Mexico, by Jonathan Brown, 1993, that was basically showing the oil context and all of this as well, and how American gunboats, including a battleship, USS Virginia, as well as several other battleships, Rhode Island and New Jersey, had been down there protecting oil interests, as well as several other cruisers from Great Britain, the Netherlands, and I think a German ship gets involved, as we'll see. So they were going up and down the Patuca River among the oil barges. There were some tank steamers and the other various gunboats. And they were stationed, I guess, about 2 miles off the entrance to the harbor. And they had been receiving several, refugees or evacuees who had been working on oil fields, both Americans as well as even Chinese workers. So they had been gathered for evacuation. But I guess because they were sort of gunboats that were circling around in the river, eventually they got rid of all their petrol. They had used it all, so they had to go ashore and were trying to get some more. And then they sort of landed on the wharf there, near where the Federalist forces were expecting advance of the Constitutionalist forces. So then they got arrested by the Federal troops and were held at gunpoint. But basically American naval officers like contacted the Mexican authorities, were like, oh yeah, you have our men. And they were like, okay, we're sorry. We're going to release them. We're very sorry about this. They actually made apologies and they gave them their gasoline. So you could say no harm, no foul, but that's not how it played out. The Admiral Henry T. Mayo, interesting name, was very insistent that General Morales Zaragoza fire a 21-gun salute to the offended American flag. So that was something that was, I guess, really important. But the Mexican authorities decided we don't really need to do that. That's kind of a strange request. So basically we decided, okay, we're going to go get Veracruz as a response. Yeah, we need to get tough. And I think at one point it was like, oh yeah, we're going to seize the customs house, get rid of this tyrant once and for all, basically. But, and then of course the inciting incident for all of this too was involved the German cargo vessel, Iprenga. We don't quite know how to pronounce that really, but, basically, yeah, there were some guns that we, I guess at one point that it was thought that these might be German weapons that were arming the Federal troops. But I guess it just turned out it was American weapons that were being sold by Americans to them just because you can get money that way. So,
yeah, well, basically, I mean, this is kind of the irony of the whole situation, is that from the U.S. business perspective, probably the best person to back in the in this, you know, civil war would have been General Huerta and the Federalist forces and so forth, not the Constitutionalists, right? Because the Constitutionalists were more of the like revolutionaries and Huertas were the counter-revolutionaries who probably would have been better for protecting U.S. business interests. And in fact, the arms shipment was an illegal shipment because I didn't even realize this, but apparently, even as far back as more than 100 years ago, the U.S. did have some provisions in place that if you overthrow a government, there are supposed to be some penalties and sanctions for that. And so remember, Huerta had overthrown and killed the previous president as part of his counter-revolution. So there were officially some sanctions in place. So some American business interests had organized this shipment of arms that was then confused by the United States Navy as being a German, like an official shipment from the German, you know, military or government or whatever. And this was again right before World War One, and there was tensions were already running pretty high, which is one reason that World War One happened. And so yeah, they basically convinced themselves that like that, you know, that these arms that were going from American businessmen to protect American interests in Mexico were actually somehow being used against them. And kind of one of the upshots, I think, of this invasion and occupation of Veracruz is that it ends up significantly hurting the forces of Huerta, right? Am I understanding that correctly? I think that's what happened. It's a little hard to keep track of the different factions, but basically it ended up, I think, helping Carranza's forces as sort of an ultimate outcome of the situation.
Well, the Americans did not want Huerta to retain arms, but eventually they still got them anyway. So it's a little unclear, you know, what the total effects was. But yeah, so the Navy's plans were to protect the oil fields remain on the shelf. However, Daniels cabled his admirals, seize Customs House at Veracruz, do not permit war supplies to be delivered to Huerta government or any other party. And then Congress approved Wilson's action, where 3,300 American troops were ashore at Veracruz, and then they detained the merchant vessel, German merchant vessel, but basically they could not confiscate the cargo because they were not at war with Germany. So then they sent the vessel on to the federally held port of Puerto Mexico, where the arms were offloaded for Huerta's troops anyway. So that, you know, sort of leads you to the questionable situation of what exactly was going on. And then apparently at Tampico, there were just like, because all of the U.S. gunboats left for Veracruz, they were basically like undefended. And then they started like claiming that they were being attacked by mobs of Mexicans. And then they were gathered with other like oil workers. They were like holed up in a hotel at one point. And then I guess like the German Marines had to basically come rescue them. This was very strange. They escorted 150 Americans to the waterfront where they were evacuated. The Americans credit the Germans with having saved them from being overrun by Mexican mobs. This was a curious exchange for the U.S. presumption of having intercepted a German merchant vessel during peacetime. This sort of like leads you back to like, you know, the era of gunboat diplomacy, where you had a couple different gunboats from a couple different naval powers just sort of patrolling the waters and, you know, making sure their oil was extracted from their, you know, Latin American clients or whatever. So this is just sort of a curious situation and some background. It's one of these like historical events that we all sort of learn about but don't really know too much of the context that was involved. And I think overall numbers at Veracruz were something like 17 U.S. soldiers dead and then something like 170 around for various Mexican losses. There were like machine guns being fired at each other and some street battles and stuff. It was eventually a relatively
small engagement, though. Kind of amusingly, it says, this is from the Wikipedia thing. After the fighting ended, Secretary of the Navy Josephus Daniels ordered that 56 medals of honor be awarded to participants in this action, the most for any single action before or since. This amount was half as many as had been awarded for the entire Spanish-American War and close to half the number that would be awarded during World War One and the Korean War. Like, they just went completely overboard, totally ridiculous, just handing out medals like candy. One of the, like, officers tried to return them, Smedley Butler, who we don't have a whole lot of time to talk about him, but he's a really interesting
figure. We've talked about him before.
Yeah, I would argue he's probably one of the most prominent, essentially anti-war military officers that the U.S. Military has ever had. And he later criticized the Veracruz operation as basically being stupid, dishonorable, and pointless or whatever. I don't have the exact quote in front of me. And he didn't like getting the medals for this. Eventually, after they had occupied the port for a while and created problems for all the different factions in this Mexican civil war, the U.S. eventually decided that Huerta, despite being this counter-revolutionary, was probably on the way out and wasn't going to succeed. But as we talked about, in 1914 and 1915, that revolutionary coalition breaks up. So then the U.S. has to figure out, well, who do we think would be the best option for us? So they decided that Carranza was the most moderate option. Now, he was not very supportive of the United States. He was pretty critical of it. But they timed their eventual withdrawal from the port of Veracruz to maximize the benefit to him in the civil war against the leftists. The U.S. recognized Carranza's government as legitimate. This allowed arms sales to be legalized instead of having the, thing that happened with the arms going to Huerta. But as a result of the Veracruz operation, Carranza kept Mexico out of World War I and refused to help the allies, including the Americans. He also refused to go in on the other side, however. There were German efforts, as we know, of course, famously, as Nate mentioned earlier, about survey courses mentioning bits and pieces of things. So the Zimmermann telegram, sort of probably the most famous little thing that people tend to remember having learned about at some point. They tried to bring Mexico in on the German side of the war. Carranza eventually gave standing military orders to try to deter the U.S. from reinvading. The U.S. had contemplated an actual full-scale invasion in 1917, and his plan was basically that the Mexican military should destroy the Mexican oil fields if U.S. troops landed again. They just instantly, blow them all up. And that was, I guess, an effective enough deterrent to prevent that from actually happening. But I do want to turn now to the other side of things. So we've talked now about the constitutionalists with Carranza and his successors from the left in the military sort of establishment that ended up getting power, as opposed to the left military factions that were out of power. So let's talk a little bit about them. At some point, we'll have to probably do an episode where we talk about Zapata's guerrilla warfare and the influence that has had even to present day. But let's talk now instead about Pancho Villa, who was, again, one of these generals who was initially part of the coalition against Huerta's counter-revolutionary forces, but then left to pursue guerrilla warfare. So, Rachel, this is the one that you looked up some stuff about, the 1916 U.S. punitive Pancho Villa expedition, or as I call it, the Yakety Sacks of counterinsurgency efforts. So tell us about who Pancho Villa was and this operation that he staged into the United States and then got a response from the United States military.
Right. So as you mentioned earlier, Pancho Villa and Zapata were kind of vying for power around the time that Carranza got installed as president. The U.S. didn't really see Carranza as a good leader, but he was tolerable. So while Carranza was nominally the president, he still had trouble holding on to power. So Zapata controlled more of southern Mexico, and then Pancho Villa kind of controlled the business interests and stuff in northern Mexico. Late 1915, Pancho Villa and his forces were kind of raising money to pursue their consolidation of power by raiding U.S. nationals living in northern Mexico and also along the border towns in Arizona, New Mexico area. One of the big things he did was he confiscated William Randolph Hearst's estate in northern Mexico, which is extremely cool. Kind of the precipitating event in March of 1916, Villa's forces attacked Columbus, New Mexico, and Camp Furlong, which was the U.S. Army post there, 10 civilians and 8 soldiers were killed in the attack, and 2 civilians and 6 soldiers were wounded. So the cause of this raid was there was a merchant living in Columbus, New Mexico, that supplied Villa with guns and ammunition. And Villa paid several thousand dollars in cash for the weapons, but the merchant refused to deliver them unless he was paid in gold. So that's what caused the raid. So in retaliation for this attack on U.S. soil, the Southern Department Commanding General Frederick Funston recommended an immediate pursuit in force into Mexico, and Wilson concurred. And he designated Brigadier General John J. Pershing to command the force. So the U.S. forces pursued via all throughout northern Mexico and some of the border towns in Texas. And this kind of went on for a year. It went on from March 1916 to February 1917. And there were these various skirmishes that occurred. A pretty major one happened in Big Bend, Texas, in May of 1916, where Villa managed to make it over the border into the U.S. and managed to kill some soldiers there, and then quickly disappeared back onto Mexican soil. Another big battle was the Battle of Carrizal, which occurred in the Mexican state of Chihuahua in June 1916. General Pershing got some information that Pancho Villa could be found in Carrizal. He sent some troops there, and he was actually confronted by Mexican army troops, not Pancho Villa's men. The Mexican army was ordered by Carranza to fire upon any American soldier moving any direction but north. So the Americans were issued a warning by the Mexican army, and the U.S. forces attacked anyway. So there's a legend that Villa was watching from the sidelines as his two enemies fought it out with each other. However, he was pretty badly injured at the time, and he was actually being pursued by both the U.S. Army and the Carrancistas. So, while this is kind of a nice, colorful tale, it probably wasn't accurate. So during this battle, the U.S. cavalry lost 2 officers and 48 men were killed and 24 were taken prisoner. And the Mexican forces lost 27, including the commanding officer, General Felix Oresti Gomez. General Pershing was furious at this result, and he actually wanted permission to attack the Mexican federal forces. But President Wilson, fearing that this would provoke a full-on war with Mexico, refused. So this basically marked the effective end of the Mexican expedition. However, forces weren't officially called back until February of 1917 after negotiations happened in the U.S. I think there were 52 negotiation events, and then finally they got called back. So they never actually succeeded in finding or killing Pancho Villa. He survived. He was allowed to retire in 1920. So it was kind of a big, kind of a black eye for the U.S., but they could save face because of the escalating tensions with Germany and entering World War I. Yeah, it just, Pancho Villa lived to stoke tensions, I guess, against the U.S., and the U.S. just never really succeeded. So.
Yeah, I mean, Pancho Villa, you know, he got to retire and live in peace for at least several years. The only reason that he ended up getting killed in the end was because he started talking about that he was maybe going to run for president in one of the later elections. And so the generals that were in power were not interested in having that happen. So that put an end to his retirement. And Nate, I think you had some notes here as well about how this was kind of a bit of a high tech operation. Like, this was, despite how bad of a failure it was, this was not like a low effort mission by the United States. This, you know, was a bit foreshadowing of some of the problems that they ran into in the early stages of the U.S. intervention in World War I in terms of not really being equipped to deal with things as well as they thought they were.
Yeah, apparently Pershing's expeditionary force, and this is according to Joshua Zeitz from Princeton and Cambridge. Basically, yeah, they had reconnaissance aircraft, Harley-Davidson motorcycles. They were searching high and low, but it was like finding needle in a haystack, according to Pershing. So basically, they could not find him. And yeah, just even it shows with all these like high-tech weapons of war, basically, that it was still quite difficult to do like counterinsurgency in this, you know, various environments, desert and other places as well. So, it could be pretty difficult. And as you mentioned, Bill, the Americans were not quite ready for World War One and sort of got thrown into the fire pretty quickly over there. So,
oh, I do just kind of have like one extra little note. So kind of continuing the theme of giving out medals for service, soldiers who took part in the Villa campaign were awarded the Mexican Service Medal. So I guess it was kind of like the participation trophy years if you served in Mexico during this time.
Oh, another thing worth mentioning from the Revolutions podcast was the presence of Soldaderas in Villa's army. And apparently he was not particularly keen on women fighting, just sort of his macho type attitudes, but there were plenty of women who were involved with the whole force, and when it came time to pick up arms, some of them did. So that was I feel like something worth mentioning just in terms of the composition. It was sort of everyone was involved. So
well, and there was also an interesting thing I had a note because I wasn't sure if we were going to get to it, but that Carranza had like his government being run by a woman like a lot of the time, which that was a whole side tangent that I was like, I don't think we're gonna have time to go into it, but Ermila Galindo, she was this Mexican feminist who was like his senior advisor. She was also like really anti-Catholic, which again, we did not have a chance to get into that, but that was like a whole thing after the revolutionary period. There was a second like low-level civil war where the atheist leftist generals like tried to go to war with the Catholic Church in Mexico. But anyway, I just thought that was interesting that like that even Carranza, between this liberal and left split, like it was a pretty dramatic departure from the sort of previous more conservative leadership in Mexico that you had these, women as senior staff in a presidential administration and so forth. We're trying to focus on the U.S. aspect in this. And part of the reason that we decided to do this one this week as we're coming back onto the show is because of the November 17th headline. This I'm reading from the Sacramento Bee now. Pete Buttigieg says he's open to sending U.S. troops to Mexico. South Bend, Indiana Mayor Pete Buttigieg said at a Latino forum in Los Angeles on Sunday that he'd be willing to send U.S. troops into Mexico to combat gang and drug violence. Quote, there is a scenario where we could have security cooperation, end quote. Even so, he added a caveat, quote, I'd only order American troops into conflict if American lives were on the line and if it were necessary to meet treaty obligations, end quote. His campaign later clarified that he would only be open to military use, quote, as a last resort, end quote, in response to Mexican cartel violence or an outside threat that endangers the country's security, which is sort of a bewildering thing in general because I don't, like, what treaty is he talking about? I don't think we have a NATO-style agreement to protect Mexico, as far as I can remember. I mean, correct me if I'm wrong on that, but I don't remember there being one. So is he saying we should have one? And interestingly, Julian Castro said, I don't think the United States should send its military down to Mexico. Mexico is a sovereign nation. He's formerly out of San Antonio, which is, one of the border communities. That was one of the reasons that we decided to do this, just because it was this kind of weird echoing back thing that cropped up after we had already put this
in the debate
on the
too,
list.
As well.
Yeah, there was another thing in the debate about it, back and forth between
Pete and Tulsi
him
went
and
after
Tulsi
it.
Gabbard. Yeah, and it's astonishing to me that we're talking about potentially again sending U.S. troops in this day and age, and from a Democrat again, like not from. This isn't Trump saying this. This is like this mainline Democrat. And it's like, what is going on here? Like, we can't keep doing this. This is so stupid, especially because the military solution was tried on the cartels fairly recently in Mexico with, Calderon, I think, was the president who was doing that. And it failed. I mean, it just ended up with these huge, like, street battles. And that didn't accomplish anything. So the idea that now we're going to also send the U.S. military, which previously got its blank completely wrecked by Pancho Villa, like, just humiliated, like, what, and after doing this in Afghanistan and Iraq and Syria for years, who thinks this is a good idea? I mean, clearly he does, but anyway, so final comments on any of this?
Well, I just think it's fairly rich, being that America is the one that's fueling all the violence, because I think we're arming the Mexican cartels, and then also, like, we're the demand for drugs. So it's fairly rich that we're causing their problems, and we also destabilize them as a result of the free trade agreement. So it's pretty rich that we would go in guns blazing when we're the cause of all their problems, or most of their problems.
American lives could be in danger, which we've never heard that one before.
I think there was also something recently where Mexican soldiers and police officers had to surrender to the son of El Chapo, or they were trying to capture him, and eventually they had to surrender a little bit. So that would be interesting if somehow then U.S. soldiers were getting involved, like being captured by the cartel or something. Like, just, I don't really think the U.S. wants to, like, poke its head into the situation where you just have a bunch of different, like, highly efficient drug cartels who engage in pretty high-tech warfare, it seems like. The U.S. has the capability, like, manpower-wise, but I just don't think it would be effective or just go well, and obviously it would be a terrible idea.
I don't even know if we do have the capacity manpower-wise.
I'm thinking, like, you know, if we, like, sent all of our divisions down there, like, maybe it would be an even fight or whatever.
Just do a permanent occupation of Mexico. Right, that's going to go very great. Yeah.
So, like, that would be what would maybe be required manpower-wise maybe. Who knows?
I don't know.
Exactly.
Mexico's an enormous country. I just don't see this going on.
Right, that's what I'm thinking. But, like, amount of troops required would then create all sorts of other problems where we'd be doing an occupation.
I just can't understand why you would even think of this as an idea for the problem. Like, because then they tried to say, oh, no, we just mean as a last resort. And it's like, why?
I think is what
Why
what
even as a last resort?
Pete's comments about the treaty obligation stuff, it's like Trump has, like, thumbed his nose at NATO so often that, like, by reverse of trying to do the opposite of what Trump is doing, that Democrats have now become like, oh, we really need to send our troops to other places to fulfill treaty obligations.
Yeah, worldwide Article 5.
Send them to Mexico. Send them wherever.
I just don't get it, though. It's like, if every other policy tool in the toolbox failed, I still wouldn't think to send troops to Mexico. I would just be like, well, I guess there's no fixing that. And I think there are any number of solutions that would work before we got to that point. I don't know. It's just mystifying to me.
Mayo Pete.
All right. Well, that's going to be it for us this week. Again, at the top of the show, we outlined a few of our upcoming topics. And again, you can hit us up at AFD Radio on Twitter to let us know your ideas for some shows that you want to hear from Arsenal for Democracy, Lendlease podcast spinoff, before we come back on the air in 2020. Thanks again for those who stuck with us over the hiatus. It was definitely very important for me to have as much time available to campaign as possible, because I ended up winning by 30 or so votes. So it was a pretty important time for me, and it paid off. I'm very happy with that result, and I'm happy that I can get back into doing the show and hearing from all of you fine folks. Rachel, thanks so much for being back on the show again, as always.
Thanks, Bill. And I'm going to echo your sentiment that I would love to hear from the listeners once again. It's been a long 2 or 3 months since we last recorded.
Okay. And Nate, thank you as well for being on the show.
Thanks, Bill. Thanks, Rachel.